Greetings. It's time for Native Sun, bringing you news of Indian country on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Bethany Williams. First, today I will be reading from the AZ Mirror. From Sheep Camp to the City to Study Uranium's Damage. This is by Alistair Lee Bitsoy, and it was published back in June on the 21st, 2024. Every summer as a kid, Kevin Patterson, 29, hiked up the Lukachukai-Chuskai Mountains following the hooves of the sheep and goats to his family's camp. Up the steep sandstone slope, the young shepherd would stop to rest at the local spring, a paradise in the summer heat. The spring is one of the rare spots on this side of the range where reeds abundantly grow. Locals harvest the reeds for basket making, including the Diné basket commonly used in ceremonies for healing. In 90-degree heat, the spring is a refuge of mist and a place to quench your thirst. Today, Patterson sits at his cubicle at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, combing through data to understand one of the biggest threats to his community back home. As beautiful as his homelands are, they're contaminated by uranium and vanadium. Between the 1940s and 80s, uranium and vanadium companies extracted these heavy metals from the Navajo Nation to make nuclear weapons. In doing so, they initiated geochemical processes that mobilized uranium and vanadium into groundwater sources. In March, this region, now known as the Lukachukai Mountains Mining District, was designated a Superfund site by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. This means the mining district is listed for priority cleanup by the federal government as a Superfund site. Although mining has stopped, the threat is still there. There are more than 500 abandoned uranium mines in the Navajo Nation that need to be cleaned up. Some date all the way back to experiments with nuclear chain reactions at Columbia University that helped start the Manhattan Project. According to the EPA, nearly 3 million tons of uranium ore have been extracted across the Navajo Nation, with families living close by many of these mines, mills, and waste sites. In 2005, the Navajo Nation banned the transport of any nuclear waste going through its lands, an area the size of West Virginia. However, Interstate 40, a major cross-country interstate, crosses the southern section of the Navajo Nation, thus allowing exceptions to this ban on major highways like Arizona's State Highways 89 and 160. The ban also prohibits any future mining or milling until all abandoned sites have been cleaned up. Earlier this spring, the Navajo Nation Council and Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin reaffirmed the ban by signing into law its position to call on the Biden administration to halt uranium hauling across Navajo lands. There's only one place in the U.S. where nuclear waste is processed, the White Mesa Uranium Mill in White Mesa, Utah. The mill, operated by Energy Fuels, Inc., receives waste shipments from as far away as the country of Estonia. The White Mesa Mill is only about 20 miles from the Navajo Nation, just across the San Juan River. According to the Grand Canyon Trust, more than 70 million pounds of toxic waste sits at the mill site. Piles of uranium dust blow in all directions. Near the Grand Canyon, tribes formed a coalition to prevent uranium mining from occurring at the Pinyon Plain Mine. Last summer, the Biden administration listened to the tribes of the region by designating 1 million acres near Grand Canyon National Park as the Bajnuavjo Itakukveni ancestral footprints of the Grand Canyon National Monument. The National Monument is the fifth national monument designated by the Biden administration through an executive order proclamation. Patterson studied Native American studies and global health at Dartmouth College and earned a master's degree in public health at Columbia, where he's now working toward a doctoral degree in environmental health sciences. His research ranges from the distribution of metal exposures in drinking water and diet across indigenous communities and their relationships with chronic health conditions. At his cubicle, he combs through data to get a better understanding of how the legacy of uranium and other metals impacts the entire Navajo Nation and other tribal lands. So far, he's learned the indigenous communities he works with are exposed to uranium, measured by uranium levels in their urine, at levels higher than the general U.S. population, and subsequently puts them at increased risk of cardiometabolic disease and kidney dysfunction. A study in the Journal of Occupational and Environmental Medicine in 2000 found that Navajo men who worked in uranium mines had excessive risk of lung cancer. The Navajo Birth Cohort Study, which is tracking pregnancy and birth outcomes among mothers and babies living near abandoned uranium mines, is another ongoing study. Researchers at the University of New Mexico and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry are working to establish connections between uranium exposure and birth defects. Patterson is calm, cool, and collected. He's very careful with his words. He's tall and handsome, wearing preppy clothes in solid colors, an indigenous Ivy Leaguer vibe. There's no confusion about his purpose. He's here to give back to his community, no matter how deep the opportunity cost is. If he were not here sitting in a cubicle in uptown Manhattan staring at a computer screen, he could be back at home helping his family, or doing environmental health research near the Rocky Mountains. "I grew up not so far from the Colorado border," Patterson says. "Being in the Rocky Mountains has really influenced the way I see my environment." He says he thinks of his studies as an environmental justice issue because some uranium mine workers, like his grandfather, who are underpaid, if they were paid at all, suffered serious health consequences. The health problems of mine workers also became a health burden for families like the Pattersons. His own mother developed breast cancer, which the family attributes to uranium exposure. Some of his grandfather's brothers, cousins, and others of his generation worked in the mining district too. They not only exposed themselves, but they exposed their families to the radioactivity from the mines when they came home from work in dirty clothes. When Patterson was growing up and realized his family was not the only one exposed to uranium's toxicity, he saw that the contaminant harms whole populations. He wanted to understand this as a problem in public health. Patterson works as a Superfund research trainee with the Health and Metals Lab group at Mailman, which explores the negative health effects from exposure to heavy metals. He also works with Dr. Ann Negra's EPI Water Group, which looks at reducing racial and socioeconomic inequities to environmental exposures in public regulated water systems. He's in the process of preparing for his doctoral qualifying exams and was recently awarded a Precision Medicine Fellowship training grant to help fund his dissertation. So far, Patterson has been published as a co-author in two publications, the Journal of Exposure Science and Environmental Epidemiology in August of 2023 and in Nature Communications in December of 22. He also penned a September 23 editorial for Environmental Health News about his work as Agents of Change for Environmental Justice, advocating for the protection of Indigenous children through clean water access. In the Journal of Exposure Science and Environmental Epidemiology, Patterson was part of a team that studied how drinking water from unregulated wells and regulated community water systems is a significant contributor to study participants' internal dose levels of urinary arsenic and uranium, even at low levels of exposure. The study relied on data from the Strong Heart Family Study, which is one of the largest longitudinal epidemiological studies among Native populations, and the multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis, which studies racial, ethnic, diverse urban communities across the U.S. The other study, from December of 22 in Nature Communications, showed there are no safe levels of exposure to arsenic or uranium, particularly in Hispanic/Latino and Native American/Alaska Native communities, who seem to have high concentrations of both arsenic and uranium concentrations in their regulated water sources. I hope that my work helps inform and highlights the repercussions of the legacy of uranium mining and milling, Patterson said, adding that the goal of his doctoral studies and research is to help the Diné public learn how they're exposed to heavy metals and the steps needed to prevent more such exposures from occurring. The U.S. EPA designates Superfund sites through a national listing that prioritizes federal dollars to help with long-term cleanup efforts to contaminated polluted sites. The Navajo Nation EPA, which also receives federal dollars, has a Superfund program that enforces the federal laws for cleanup. Patterson studies this data to find regional patterns. Meanwhile, he wonders just how badly his own family has been exposed, especially now that the whole area has been designated a Superfund site. This area includes Cove, Lukachukai, and Round Rock, Arizona. His families are from both Lukachukai and Round Rock. The Lukachukai-Chuskai Mountains are some of the highest peaks across the Navajo Nation, with Roof Butte being the tallest, and on the horizon from Patterson's family sheep camp at 9,823 feet. I do think there's been a pretty personal interest of my own with the work that I've been doing since childhood, Patterson said. He said he has a hard time digesting whether to be okay with his community being designated a Superfund site. In some ways, the designation does not change anything at all, except to declare his homelands a priority for cleanup by the federal government. Actionable change starts with the community, and he says he hopes future Diné scientists will continue this work. But his community will forever be impacted, regardless of cleanup efforts. Whether the spring the sheep and goats drank from has traces of uranium and vanadium remains to be studied. I honestly don't know what I would be doing instead. For this lack of knowing otherwise, I feel justified in knowing I'm doing work that I'm called to, Patterson said. I've always wanted to pursue a PhD, but the path there wasn't always clear. Even now, the path forward after the PhD is still unclear, but I want to make a difference for my family and my community. And that was From Sheep Camp to the City to Study Uranium's Damage to Navajo People. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona has been bringing you audio access to print information for over 40 years. Learn more at our website, sunsounds.org, where you can listen to our live streams or listen to individual episodes on demand. ICT occasionally publishes biographies of short biographies of notable historical people. This one is about Carlos Montezuma and is written by Raymond Wilson. Was published on July 29th, 2024. The exact year Carlos Montezuma's birth is unknown. The Yavapai man was born between 1865 and 67 near Fort McDowell in Arizona Territory. What is known, however, is his career as a medical physician, author, newsletter editor, and staunch advocate for Indian reform, especially demanding the elimination of the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs. His parents named him Wasaja, translated as signaling or beckoning, and later in life he used this name for his newsletter that he created in April of 1916. During a skirmish with the Pima in 1871, Wasaja was among the prisoners taken by the Pima, who later sold him to Carlo Gentile, an Italian photographer. Gentile adopted the child and named him Carlos Montezuma. After months of travel to several locales, Gentile and Montezuma traveled to Chicago in 1872. Because of his connections, Gentile convinced Buffalo Bill Cody to hire Montezuma to play Azteca, a stereotyped native character who was billed as the son of Apache leader Cochise in The Scouts of the Prairie and Red Deviltry as It Is. The stage show production was performed in several eastern cities. Montezuma left the show in March of 1873. Montezuma attended several public schools and became an exceptional student. Graduating from Urbana High School in Illinois in 1879, again, Gentile played a major role in convincing the American Baptist Home Mission Society to help Montezuma attend the University of Illinois in 1880, after completing preparatory university work. He also received financial aid from the university and the YMCA. Graduating in 1884 in the pharmaceutical program with a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry, Montezuma wrote his senior thesis, entitled Valuation of Opiums and Their Products. Additionally, he was chosen as president of the class of 1884 and served as president of the Adelphic Debate Society. Montezuma decided to become a medical physician, and again, with the help of friends, entered Chicago Medical College in 1884. Although he received financial aid, he earned his medical degree in 1889 instead of 88 because he struggled financially and had to work outside of class. He was the second native to receive a medical degree from an institution of higher learning, Dr. Susan LaFleche Picot, Omaha, being the first. Initially unable to establish a successful private practice, Montezuma worked as a BIA physician between 1889 and 96, first at Fort Stevenson Indian School, North Dakota, then at the Western Shoshone Agency in Nevada, next at the Colville Agency in Washington, and finally at Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. His years among natives at these places convinced him that federal Indian policies had dramatically failed to provide better health care to natives, as well as improve economic, political, and social conditions. He later demanded the BIA be abolished. In 1896, Montezuma returned to Chicago and joined a private practice with a prominent non-native physician he had known previously. Montezuma specialized in internal and stomach medicine, worked long hours, secured permanent employment for decades, and became more of an advocate for native reforms. He made many trips back to his homeland in Arizona to help his people, especially with land and water rights. Additionally, on April 7, 1904, Sioux performers from Buffalo Bill's Wild West show riding on the Chicago and Northwestern Railway Company were involved in a terrible train wreck near Melrose Park, Illinois. Montezuma received permission from the BIA to attend to native medical needs and tried to get the injured parties adequately compensated. He estimated fair compensation for the survivors was $51,250. The railroad countered with $11,900 damage payments, which was ultimately approved. Montezuma was among the founders of the Society of American Indians, a pan-Indian organization established in 1911 that focused on important native issues. He was often at odds with some SAI members, particularly regarding what Montezuma considered their overly positive relationship with the BIA. Regarding Native participation in World War I, Montezuma contended that Natives should not be drafted. He argued it should be their choice to serve, and to the U.S. granted them citizenship. In addition to his lectures to various local and national organizations beginning in the 1880s, Montezuma wrote articles in The Red Man and in the Quarterly Journal of the Society of American Indians, renamed the American Indian Magazine in 1916, two important native publications. His major outlet, however, was Wasaja, a monthly newsletter that Montezuma founded in April of 1916 and published until November 1922. The impressive mastheads displayed how natives suffered under BIA policies, and his editorials expressed his staunch beliefs on how natives should be treated and respected. On a personal note, Montezuma married Mary Keller, a non-native, on September 19, 1913. Earlier, he had some poor, serious relationships with other women he dated, including Gertrude Simmons Bonin, also known as Zitkala Shah, a Yankton Sioux and noted Native activist. They became engaged, but Bonin called off the engagement and married another. Montezuma was extremely hurt, and in addition, Bonin lost the engagement ring. Montezuma realized Natives had to change to survive in the dominant culture. As the years passed, he became more of an advocate of acculturation and believed reservations, if supported by better federal political, economic, and social programs, would provide natives with the tools they needed to participate and succeed as U.S. citizens. On January 31, 1923, Montezuma died from tuberculosis and was buried at Fort McDowell Cemetery in Arizona. Sources are Carlos Montezuma Papers, Society of the American Indian Papers, Peter Iverson, Carlos Montezuma and the Changing World of American Indians, 1982, and Leon Spiroff, Carlos Montezuma, M.D., A Yavapai American Hero, 2003. And that was Carlos Montezuma. This next was published by the Associated Press. No Pads Nor Mercy in What May Be the Oldest Game in North America, by Graham Lee Brewer, published on the 24th of July, 2024. As drummers walk onto the field, the players behind them smack their hickory sticks to the beat. The rhythm envelops the stands, and a palpable sense of anticipation flows through the crowd. Indigenous peoples have been playing stickball for hundreds of years, and every summer since 1975, teams have competed in Mississippi to become champion of perhaps the oldest game in North America. A game of physicality and endurance, stickball is often referred to as the grandfather of field sports, and the annual tournament in Mississippi is the game's premier event. For generations, the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians has been producing some of the country's best players at stickball, not to be confused with the baseball-like game played on the streets of big cities. A team from Mississippi will almost certainly be the one to beat in any tournament or exhibition game in the country. As the July sun set on another sweltering day, hundreds of people gathered at the Choctaw Central High School football field and sat on the Indian blankets they had draped across the metal seating. Others lined their folding chairs along the chain-link fence to get a glimpse of the action. Stickball, known as ishtaboli in the Choctaw language, is played with 30 players on the field, each carrying two netted sticks, called kabocha, and a small woven leather ball, painted bright orange, called a towa. Stickball fans say it remains pure. There are no pads, no timeouts, and no mercy. Players typically don't even wear shoes. It's not uncommon for people to leave the stickball field with broken bones from full contact or gashes from taking a stick to the face. Any player possessing the ball can expect to be tackled or torn down by their jersey or breechcloth. It makes your heart just beat like a drum, just the intensity of the sport, Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians chief Cyrus Benn said. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what color, jersey, or what team. It's being Choctaw. Although the game is high contact, it is so respected by the Choctaw and so central to their cultural identity that no hit is taken personally, no matter how intense. Players often slam each other so hard their sticks go flying through the air, and they simply get back up, nod to each other, and race down the field after the ball. Variations on stickball have traditionally been played by several tribal nations using rules created by the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. Players are not allowed to hit each other with their sticks, although that happens routinely when players huddle around a loose ball. Late or early tackles are prohibited, and anything above the shoulders is off limits. Chief Ben, like many here, was given a pair of sticks as soon as he could walk. Some recall sleeping with them above their pillows and a ball underneath. Boys and girls play together in the youth tournaments the night before the men's and women's championship games every year at the Choctaw Indian Fair. All over town, you will see kids with sticks poking out of their backpacks. The field is never empty. Children play stickball before every game, living out their fantasy of one day claiming victory on the same field. Between that, the snow cone stand, and the almost fanatical way the assistant coaches scream from the sidelines, it's as familiar as any Friday night high school football game. This year, Koni Hata, the 2023 men's champion and one of the most dominant teams in the modern era of stickball, defended its dynasty in both the men's and women's title games against neighboring Choctaw communities such as Pearl River and stickball powerhouse Boxito. The finals started with the women's championship, Boxito Ohoyo taking on Konihata Ohoyo, which was looking for its second three-peat in the last 7 years. Scoreless at the end of regulation play, the game was decided in sudden death when Boxito Ohoyo center shooter Leah Phillips scored with a running midfield shot. I said, "Yeah, it's my time to shine. This is my shot right here. You worked all year for this," Phillips, the women's tournament MVP, said after the game. The men's game between Konihata and Pearl River was highly physical, and several skirmishes for the ball ended with sticks shooting through the air like my 9-iron, one announcer said. Several players were treated by medics for a variety of injuries, including a bleeding eye and a gash across the forehead. Earlier in the tournament, a player suffered from a broken nose. Pearl River had no trouble scoring during tournament play, racking up an impressive 41 points in its first 3 games. They scored in the first half, but the point was negated for having 31 players on the field. Konihata scored in the second half, but that point was also taken away for having too many players on the field. But Pearl River scored late in the fourth quarter and took home the ceremonial drum presented by Chief Ben. As the Choctaw Indian Fair was winding down, Jackie Morris, the coach of the team from the community of Boxito, waited in line for a hot dog. He made sure that every passing Boxito player had the chance to sign the drum slung over his shoulder. "This is what we play for," he said, patting the trophy. On the field nearby, drums and sticks beat together. That was the article, "One of the Oldest Games in North America You've Likely Never Heard Of." And it includes dozens of really good photographs that I wish I had time to describe all to you, but I do not, because it is the end of my time with Native Sun, the show for Indigenous issues on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Bethany Williams. Music is Land Back by Hallucination.